expecting a call from Scottsdale. She waited on the sofa as I began making a fire in the moss rock fireplace. The dog dutifully groaned and stretched out on the Navajo rug in front of the hearth. Periodically, his eyes would glance toward the rifle tucked into the corner by the door. He did it more than once, and I was sure he was seeing something over there that I couldn't. I was thinking about the Espers and Artie Small's song when I noticed her looking at me.
"How's it going?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"The case. I'm betting that's what you're thinking about."
She took a sip of her drink and continued as I tried to think up a harmless subject to distract her with.
"It's okay if I were you. It's all I would think about."
I smiled, nodded, and looked at my lap. On the way over here, I was looking forward to spending the evening with someone who had no connection with it. She looked over the rim of her glass.
"Great expectations."
I took a sip of my own drink and reassessed. I spent the day out on the reservation with Henry. The phone rang, and she picked it up and talked to some real estate broker in Arizona about some property she wanted to buy in the White Mountains. I listened to the one-sided conversation as they discussed an investment property that was going to cost more than our county's yearly fiscal budget. When she hung up, I asked, "Get it?"
"She's going to call me back. They're being cranky about the mineral rights."
She paused for a moment.
"I'm sorry, it's incredibly rude, but if I don't act on this now, I'm not likely to get it."
"It's okay," I smiled. "You're quite the wheeler dealer."
"I keep my hand in. I'm acquiring a lot of property on the southern portion of the Powder River right now. I even bought some land from the family of one of those boys."
"The Espers?"
"There's talk of a power plant out there."
I smiled some more.
"What?"
"You're just not what I picture as a robber baron."
"Robber baroness."
She looked at the fire. "Something wrong?"
She took a moment to answer. "No. I was just thinking about that girl."
"Melissa?"
"Yes."
She turned back to me.
"She cleaned out here for a summer with her aunt, but it just didn't work out."
She looked sad and changed the subject.
"Walter, how in the world did you ever end up in law enforcement?"
"In the Marines, during Vietnam." I looked at her for a good while, taking in all the details. Her hair was down, and I noticed how thick and luxurious it was, held back from her face on one side by a single etched silver barrette that draped the reddish curtain behind one ear. It was like a box seat to a command performance. The earring that showed was a roweled spur studded with little turquoise and coral stones and dangling jingle bobs. She had great ears, even better than mine. Up close, I could see the wrinkles around her eyes, and it was nice. They softened the lupine slant, and the soft brown in her eyes looked inviting, like the mud on the banks of streams that beg you to take off your shoes and wade through them. I squirmed a little and started in. I graduated in 66, lost my deferment, and got drafted by the Marines. I got the letter, and it scared the shit out of me. Hell, I didn't even know the Marines could draft you. I got through Paris Island, officer's training, and because I was big, got shuffled into the Marine Military Police, which meant that I got to do exciting things like man checkpoints at traffic control areas, provide convoy security, investigate motor vehicle accidents, and patrol off-limit areas. And then there was the traditional task of maintaining good order and discipline within the battalion. I turned to look at her, stiffening my back for effect.
"I guess you don't forget that stuff."
I laughed and looked over at the fire. "No, you don't. Now, granted, I was just some dumb kid from Wyoming, but it was all pretty confusing."
"The war?"
"The war, the military, a foreign country. Hell, I was just getting used to California. So I decided to devote myself to the police side of my job. It was the only part that seemed to make sense. It wasn't easy because the Marine Police were not a formalized occupational specialty. We were only cops on a rotational basis, operating under a skeleton force of Navy officers. I was lucky, and after a while I gained some experience and credibility as an investigator.
How did you do that?
A couple of cases.
You don't want to talk about it?
I went back to looking at the fire. They're not good stories.
Good?
Happy.
Oh.
She shifted and warmed up both of our drinks with straight rum.
Do I seem like the kind of person who only wants to hear happy stories?
Maybe not, but I'm not sure I want to be the one to tell you the sad ones. She held on to my glass and wouldn't let me have it. I laughed. All right, you've broken me. I took a sip of the almost straight rum and thought back, remembering the heat. In January of 68, I was assigned as a liaison to the 379th Air Police Squadron, 379th Combat Support Group, NCOIC Air Police Investigations. A number of Corps personnel were shuttled in and out of Tansan Nut Air Force Base, and a lot of them were turning up self-medicated.
So, the Air Force called in the Marines?
Oh, no, not at all. They didn't want me there, but the Marine Corps Provost Marshal's office did. They saw it as a wonderful opportunity for me to get some on-the-job training from the investigative operations officer there, who was career Air Force and who consequently hated my guts because I was a Marine.
Nobody told him we were fighting the North Vietnamese?
Only as a secondary front. I laughed a little at the absurdity of the situation long past. I was assigned to him, but I wasn't particularly one of his. I broke up a lot of fights, patrolled a lot of outlying areas like Laos and Cambodia.
You're joking.
Yeah, but I did get to meet Martha Ray. This time she laughed hard. Don't get me wrong, a lot of the air police I worked with were the best, but they were overworked, and sometimes it helps to have a new set of eyes come in from outside. The Vietnamese were selling it right on the base in exchange for black market items from the PX. There were an awful lot of Vietnamese military police involved as ringleaders. I tracked the problem back to Air Force personnel.
They must have really loved you for that.
Semper Fi.
What else? You said there were a couple of cases.
Yep, I did. I took another hit from my drink and rested it on my knee. The plain rum with the sugar remnants and cinnamon sticks was surprisingly good. There was this prostitute that was killed off base. We really didn't have any jurisdiction, but I made a personal campaign out of it. She put her hand out and rested it along the back of the sofa near my shoulder.
How have you survived doing this for so long? I mean, you still care.
Her eyes closed a little like they did.
Do most guys still care after 30 years in this line of work?
I thought for a moment. No, I don't think they can afford it. Nobody makes an emotional bulletproof vest, so you just have to carry the shrapnel around with you. It took her a long time to respond.
You must be tough.
I turned and looked at her. No, I'm not. It's one of my secret weapons. She smiled. There was this prostitute in the village up near Hotel California, this old French fort where they house an Arvan company at the northernmost tip of Tansan Nut Air Base. It looked like something out of Beau Geste. It had 20-foot walls that were 3 feet thick, whitewashed concrete that formed a perfect rectangle. It had solid iron gates that shut the arched doorways into this huge courtyard with all these smaller cubicles. There was a small village out past the fence line, a civilian mortuary, and a cemetery with thousands of little white headstones. I thought back as I told the story, and it was amazing how all the details were still there, like some carefully packed footlocker that had withstood the consistent inspection of time. Her name was Maikim, and I met her over Tiger Beers in the village at the Boy Howdy Boku Good Times Lounge. They told us not to drink the water, so I didn't, habitually.
Were you a customer?
No. They told us not to do that either, and I was a young Marine and did what I was told. She laughed some more. She was cute, though. Had good teeth. A rarity in that place. She was tiny, and she loved to talk about America. She took a great deal of pride in the fact that she had lots of American friends.
As many as money could buy.
Yep, but she was better than that.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean...
No, I know that. I rushed ahead so she would know that no feelings were hurt. They had an old upright piano in the bar, and I know I single-handedly overdosed all of Vietnam with Fats Waller and Pete Johnson. I thought for a moment. She would read Stars and Stripes at the bar between clients, and I would help her with the pronunciations and meanings of words she didn't understand. After the drug thing, none of the Air Force guys would talk to me, and neither would the Vietnamese police, so I talked to her. I paused a moment, remembering. She had a great voice, husky like yours, like she had just gotten out of bed. I nodded. In retrospect, she probably had. Another laugh.
She died?
Yes. Badly. I looked back at the fire and listened to the dog breathe. Her body was found in one of our abandoned forward bunkers. She'd been raped and strangled. I still remember the crime scene. The killer had pulled down a number of the sandbags to make a bed, and it all looked so normal until you saw her eyes or the marks on her neck. I started to take another sip of my rum, but stopped a little ways away from my mouth to just smell it. Nobody was talking. Nobody. So there I was, at the last outpost of the last war, investigating a murder that nobody cared about. I exhaled a short breath, laughing at myself. It was my way of introducing a little order into the chaos. She waited a moment, but she had to ask, "Did you get him?" The dog yawned loudly and rolled over on his back. I watched as his huge fan of a tail slowly dropped. War stories. I'm even boring the dog to death.
Who did it?
I took another sip of my rum and got cagey. Can't tell you all my stories, and you wouldn't have a second date with me. She punched my shoulder, and I continued to lighten my tone. She wanted to live in Tennessee. One of her customers must have sold her on it, telling her how it was the greatest place in the world. The volunteer state, where Elvis was from. She knew everything there was to know about Tennessee. I looked at the pineapple upside-down dog and waited. But she didn't say anything. Okay, let's talk about you.
Oh, no.
Yep, fair's fair. It's your turn.
I don't have interesting stories like you.
I gave her my most disbelieving look. Tell me about New York. Isn't that where you were for all those years? She laughed. I had a gallery on the Upper East Side near 86th Street. What did you sell?
Really shitty, expensive art.
You seem defensive.
I'm an artist.
She swirled the sugar from the bottom of her glass.
We're always defensive about shitty art. Afraid we might be producing it.
Are you still sculpting? She was talking into her glass, her eyes avoiding mine, so I placed my arm across the back of the sofa and gently touched her hair when the phone rang again. She looked at me with a sad smile and brushed her cheek against my hand before leaning over and answering it. I listened for a while, then got up and went over to the fire. The dog's eye opened, and his head looked even bigger with the ears trailing up, but he didn't move. I reached down, patted his stomach, and the eye closed. I guess he liked me. Or at least, he trusted me. I sat on the elevated hearth, pulled the poker from the stand at the right, and jostled the logs into a more active position. The glowing red embers made a checkerboard across the burning wood, and small sparks disappeared up into the darkness of the chimney. The wind continued to howl in the flume, and I thought about getting home. Tomorrow was the back-to-zero day. I figured I'd start with the Cody scene. If it was a murder, that was where the killer had started. I would re-examine all the evidence, the feather, the guns, and the ballistics sample. Then I would start re-interviewing. I was going to have to circle the wagons and bring Turk back. I looked at the dog, and he was looking at the rifle beside the door again. A little over 2 years. 2 years since the suspended sentences for all four boys. Why now? It just didn't make sense. Why single out Cody Pritchard? He had been the most repugnant during the trial, but why kill him now? The feather was a real twist, and somehow I had to get some answers from it. I looked back at the Cheyenne rifle of the dead. Was it speaking in tongues? Could the dog hear it? I was dealing in a subject matter in which it was expert. I wished I had a war party of old Cheyenne to follow me around and whisper things in my ear about life and death. Would old Little Bird or Standing Bear help me find the killer of the boy that had raped their great-great-great-granddaughter? I don't know precisely why, but I believed they would. Lucian had told me stories about them, about their honor, their grace, and their pursuit of the Cheyenne virtues. There was this incident back in 49 where Lucian did this routine pullover of an older Indian couple who were driving just outside of Durant and were headed for the reservation. He said it was one of those wonderful winter nights when the wind had died down and the snow looked like scalloped icing on a vanilla cake. The moon was full and bright, bright enough for him to spot this old Dodge slide through a stop sign, make a right, and head for the res with no taillights. Lucian wheeled the old Nash around and pulled in behind their car to just give them a warning about the lack of illumination aft. He said it took 2 miles for them to pull over, and they were only doing about 20 miles an hour. I could just see that little bandy rooster straightening his belt and buttoning up his old Eisenhower jacket as he got out and walked on 2 then solid legs up to the ancient black primer Dodge. I could see him pushing his old campaign hat back with a thumb like he used to do, and leaning on the back of the Dodge's windowsill as the window rolled down. "Hey, Chief!" He wasn't joking. Frank Red Shield was a chief of the Northern Cheyenne. "I pulled you over 'cause you've got a couple of taillights out back here." He said the old chief's eyes twinkled, and he patted Lucian's arm that rested on the car. "Oh, that's okay. I thought you were pulling me over 'cause I didn't have no license." Lucian said he nearly bit his lip to bleeding, trying to not laugh, until Mrs. Redshield slapped her husband across the chest and said, "Don't pay no attention to him, Sheriff. He don't know what he's saying when he's been drinking." I smiled and laughed to myself. Maybe the old guys and the rifle were already helping me. I was aware of some movement from the sofa and looked up to find Vonnie holding the phone out to me. I'd been so wrapped up in my musings that I hadn't even heard it ring again. Her face was immobile and her shoulders shook like she was cold. "It's for you." I looked at the phone, back to her, and then reached over and took it from her. She looked scared and I suddenly felt very tired. I heard my voice say, "Sheriff." I listened to the static of the mobile phone and the pitched battle the wind was having with her wherever she was. Her voice was tight, and she was straining to be heard over the howl that seemed to match its brother in the fireplace perfectly. "Well, we found one of the espers." Chapter 9. Welcome to Hooverville. It was creeping up on midnight, and she was trying not to look like a turtle with her head ducked down in the artificial brown fur of her duty jacket. "Where is he?" She turned into the steady wind, with her hands buried in the depths of her coat pockets, and led me over to where all the headlights were shining. The pulse of the blue and red lights reflected off the frozen gravel of the impromptu parking lot that had been set up along the barbed wire fence. Hooverville referred to the assortment of little shacks that surrounded Dull Knife Lake at the southern part of the Bighorn Mountains, and was known by the locals as the South End. Outside the jurisdiction of the Cloud Peak Wilderness Area and the federal government, numerous lots had been bought and sold and built upon until the surrounding shoreline resembled a collection of chicken coops. Some of the little cabins weren't bad, but the majority were hunting trailers with little annexes attached that had been towed in a long time ago. The fishing was good all around the lake, but the view was better at the northern part, where the shore got steeper and the water disappeared into the thick forest. I thought about the original Hooverville in Washington, D.C., where World War I veterans had been chased out of town, and figured it would take a young Patton and MacArthur to clean this one out, too. I shined the beam of my flashlight in the path and saw that the single set of tracks leading to the body were slowly filling in. I gave Vic my keys and asked her to repark my truck so that it would form a snow fence that would knock down the wayward flakes that were impeding the crime scene investigation. It was Jacob Esper, all right, sitting with one foot folded underneath him and the other sticking straight out. He was leaning against the rear wheel of his truck and had a quizzical look on his face. There was a small torn spot at the center of his Carhartt jacket, and he was surrounded by a frozen liquid with brown shading. Dried blood, discounting the temperature, 30 minutes to 2 hours. I didn't have to worry about his back, since most of it was a frozen smear on the side of the dirty truck. It started with the explosion behind the door and trailed to where he now sat. His eyes were open, but Tashnoir had already set in. 3 hours. I reached out and tugged at his boot. The body was stiff with fully developed rigor. 6 to 24 hours. We needed a body core temperature, and we weren't going to get it for another 7 hours. One of the footprints behind Vic's yellow nylon barrier was close to me, so I blew into it and examined the impression. About a size 9, medium width. At the arch was a registered trademark, Skywalk, with a medallion print of some kind with words around the edges and a diminutive mountain range. The headlights subsided in shadow for a moment. Where are they?
Over there in the Hummer. They're about to run out of gas from operating the heater, so they're in a hurry.
Oh, really?
I told them you'd be real concerned. She stamped her feet, trying to get some feeling back in them. I wasn't sure about how to secure the site, but Ferg and I thought we could zip-tie the tarp to the top of the truck and then tie it off to another vehicle. It's probably going to flap like a windjammer cruise, but...
Yep.
I looked around me, trying to absorb it all, because in another hour it might look like Stalingrad. There were trailing wisps of snow dunes arching away from the higher points of Jacob's body already.
Tire tracks?
She kneeled down beside me. Only those guys, pulling in once, circling back out and then pulling in again.
How do they call?
Cell phone.
Why do they pull out?
Bad reception.
You look at the boot prints?
Yeah, Vasques. So is the dearly departed and one of the execs.
Popular boot.
Popular size.
We both shrugged and looked at Jacob. No sheep?
She pursed her lips and shook her head. No sheep. Preliminary triangulation indicates an area across the lake, maybe even over where those really shitty-looking cabins are.
I turned in the opposite direction from the truck and peered through the darkness and the snow. The headlights of Vic's unit weren't helping. We stood up to escape them and strained our eyes into the darkness. Where would you shoot from?
Top of that ridge, along the tree line.
I turned to look at her. Any local activity?
They say they heard somebody shouting over on the other side about the time they pulled in, around 9.
What are they doing pulling in here at 9 o'clock at night? Supposed to borrow a cabin from Dave McClure, drove up from Casper after work. Now they're not sure if they have the right day.
It's Tuesday. She nodded.
That fact's been established and corroborated. Ferg is checking with Dave about their plans.
I thought about the next move. Get the tarp tied down as soon as Ferg gets off the radio.
She stomped her feet again. DCI in Wheatland by now?
Weather permitting.
She was looking at the side of my face as I looked at Jacob. We're not going to be able to keep him out.
I continued to look at Jacob.
Walt?
Get Ferg to help you get the tarp done. Then tell him to get that metal detector he has at home and check that hillside over there when he gets back.
Gets back?
Then get in your truck, put on your winter gear and warm up.
She stopped stomping, looked at me for a while longer, and then went off to check on Ferg.
She was right. We had gone from a sleepy little death by misadventure to a multiple homicide. And the Division of Criminal Investigation was going to want their pound of post-mortem flesh. The nagging voice of reason kept reminding me that their experience and technical capabilities gave them a much better chance of breaking the case, but then a stronger voice came in and stated flatly that this was my case and my county. Along the way, it had gotten personal. The first thing I had to do was get the two remaining boys out of county, out of state. Out of the country, if I had to. Lucian would say there was a fox in the henhouse, and I would say it was time to get the chickens on down the road. I turned back to Jacob. He hadn't changed much. Dead men don't tell tales, but I always expect them to pop up and tell me it had all been a big joke. In 30 years of law enforcement, I had been deeply disappointed. The interior light of Jacob's truck was on, but very dimly. The door was ajar, keychain hanging from the ignition. I looked under the truck at the exhaust, where a few drips of condensate were frozen at the bottom of the tailpipe. There was a shallower impression in the snow where the exhaust would have blown out and a large slick of ice under the engine. I glanced down the fender for insignia, and sure enough, it said diesel. Jacob had started his truck to let it warm up, and whatever had happened had happened when he was exiting or re-entering the vehicle. With the orientation of the body, I would think that he was getting out. I'm pretty sure he had been sitting here like this, and the truck had run out of fuel. There were no fishing rods lying about, and he wasn't wearing a vest, waders, or any of the other accoutrement that fishermen usually wore. I stood up and walked around the truck to get a look inside. The passenger side door was locked. Hardly anybody ever does that in Wyoming. There was frost on the inside of the windows, but I could still make out a couple of aluminum fly rod cases lying along the seat, two vests and a small cooler. The cooler was a battered old thing with a bumper sticker on it that read, "Charlton Heston is my president." Working with the preliminary observations, without checking for discoloration of the right and left sides of the abdomen, the victim had been dead approximately, and I was guessing, 14 to 16 hours, which placed the time of death at the earliest at 5 o'clock this morning. If there were trout in the cooler, I could reasonably assume that Jacob had been fishing early. Before dawn? I looked around the rest of the truck for a tent, sleeping bag, or any other evidence that he might have spent more than one day. There were the cabins, but we were going to have to do a sweep of them anyway. I walked back around the truck and looked at the spot where the gore of his heart and part of a lung had sprayed against the edge of the bed. That meant there was lead in the hillside adjacent to the gravel lot, or in the truck, or in Jacob. Maybe. Something moved under the truck, and I lowered my perspective to see what it was. Jacob's black cowboy hat had blown under the transfer case and had lodged against one of the front wheels. There was a small collection of feathers stuck in the side of the headband. I looked back at the boy's dull eyes, shining my flashlight along his body, and got to wondering. I stood, leaning over the body, and extended the flashlight to the open section of his jacket and pushed it back just enough to reveal the pristine tip of a bleached, straightened, min-waxed turkey feather.
"What in the hell is going on over here?"
I'm pretty sure I stood up and turned around faster than I ever had before. He was a little older than me, well below medium height, but nowhere near medium build. He had a face like an old prize fighter, bulbed and knobby wherever it protruded. It was like life was bound to come out, even if circumstance was bound to pound it in, and circumstance was standing over him at the moment. Circumstance also noted the broken blood vessels and the flaccidness of the rest of his face. This was not an amateur drinker, but a full-blown alcoholic. As my eyes traveled down the open, olive-drab parka, past the polyester fur around the hood and the red-and-white striped tank shirt to the bulging stomach, I noticed the floral print swimming trunks and the thin, bird-like legs that extended into a pair of unlaced Arctic boots. I also noticed the drink in his hand in a martini glass, complete with a sour apple slice and a little green paper parasol. "Who are you?" He wasn't paying any attention to me, but had leaned to one side to get a better look at the crime scene.
"Holy shit!"
I moved over a little, blocking his view.
"Excuse me?"
He looked back at me and actually saluted.
"Sorry, General. What's up?"
I sighed and repeated the question.
"Al Monroe, I got one of them cabins over by the lake."
He listed farther to the side.
"Jesus, he's deader than hell."
"Mr. Monroe, have you been up here long?"
"Last 3 days, had a hell of a drunk going till I saw all these damn lights over here. Thought somebody died."
He took a sip of his martini and looked at me thoughtfully.
"Looks like somebody fucking did."
As I stared at the spectacle of Al Monroe, a thought occurred to me. "Al, can you make coffee over at your cabin?"
"Oh, hell yeah, best coffee on the mountain."
"Would you mind going over and making us a big pot? It looks like we're going to be here for a while."
"You damn well bet."
He saluted again and traipsed off toward the lake.
"Al,"
he turned as Vic came up beside me, "which one of the cabins is yours?" He pointed in the vague direction of one of the dilapidated shacks across the water. He saluted again before he climbed onto an enormous mule with only a rope lead and disappeared into the darkness without spilling a drop of his martini. Vic looked after the departing vision.
"Who the fuck was that?"
I looked sidelong at her.
"You two are going to get along."
The two execs in the Hummer calmed down when I explained that they wouldn't have to worry about a place to stay and that the sheriff of Absaroka County always had a few extra beds he could share with the primary witnesses to a homicide. I told them that I would be happy to put them up for 3 to 6 weeks, meals included. They said no thanks. Maybe they'd heard about the pot pies on weekends, but either way, they got a lot more cooperative, and that was all I was really after. They had arrived from Casper after dark and had seen the truck when they drove by the first time. They were supposed to meet Dave McClure, but weren't sure which cabin was his. They had seen the truck and circled around to ask directions. By the time they had, the truck had stopped running. They pulled into the parking lot, and one of them got out to check on the guy who looked like he was resting on the ground. They hadn't touched anything and said the only reason they had driven halfway back to Muddy Guard Ranger Station was so that they could get reasonable reception on their cell phone. 911 had routed them through to us. Vic had responded, and here we were, standing in the wind and snow. I asked them about the yelling, and they said that someone had hollered at them from across the lake when they first pulled up to the scene. From the direction and colorful and varied usage of language, it could only have been the now infamous Al Monroe. He had wanted to know if he could interest them in a sour apple martini or 12. Ferg had gotten through to a sleepy Dave McClure, who not only backed up the men's story, but also told us the location of his place and about the key that was hidden on the top shelf of his grill. I released them to go warm up in Dave's cabin and joined Vic and Ferg as they set up work lights and began taking photographs of the scene. Vic lowered the camera
and set her shoulders. "Is that what I think it is? Sticking out of the deceased's jacket?"
"Yep." I folded my arms and started in. "Ferg?" He joined me after adjusting the work lights, and the warmth of the halogen felt good along my shoulders. "You're going to have to make the run." He said he didn't mind. Ferg was my mule, and I wouldn't trade him for all the thoroughbreds in the world. "Get Ruby to throw us together some supplies, sandwiches and coffee. Tell her to arrange with Lucian to pull an early watch on dispatch and to bring Turk up from powder."
"Lucian?"
I nodded. "Yes, Lucian. Also bring Brian Keller and George Esper in under protective custody."
"To the jail?"
Vic half snarled.
"No, the fucking Motel 6.
We were all under a lot of pressure, and having maximized our manpower to burgeoning, I ushered Ferg to his truck. "Call the Espers, and then go by there if you have to. If they're still not there, Reggie Esper's sister lives in Longmont, Colorado. Call the Longmont City Police and tell them that we're looking for whatever it is that the Espers have registered with the DMV other than this maroon diesel."
"Then what?"
"Get back up here." I watched as he jumped in his little navy Toyota. I knocked on the window. "Ferg?" He rolled it down and leaned out. "Do you have one of those little digital breathalyzers?" He handed it to me with a questioning look. "Don't forget that metal detector, and thanks." I stuffed the device in my pocket and walked back to where Vic was still taking photographs. "When you get through, get in your truck and warm up some more. It's going to be a long night. I'm going to walk over and get a statement from Al Monroe." She nodded, lining up for the next shot. "Good luck." It turned out to be a half mile around the east bank of the lake. No wonder Al had ridden his mule. Al's cabin was homemade. It didn't have the singularity of purpose of those that had started out as campers. The original structure was a 16-by-16 shack, complete with T-111 siding and a multicolored tin roof. The rest of the cabin was made of lean-tos, which leaned, too, with such ambition that the outer perimeter of the cabin lay on the ground. I wasn't sure what Al did for a living, but it was a safe bet it wasn't carpentry. The mule was in one of the upright lean-tos directly beside the cabin, and I had to take care not to step into her leavings. There were a good 3 cords of wood stacked alongside the door. The harsh glow of propane lighting illuminated the windows and the 2-inch crack under the door on which I had just knocked. After a moment, I knocked again.
"Hold your goddamn horses!"
I listened to more stumbling, crashing, and profanity. He yanked open the door, and waves of heat rolled from the interior of the cabin, along with the smell.
"Come on in, General. Coffee's ready."
The interior of Al's cabin was far worse than the outside, kind of like Fibber McGee's closet gone bad. There was a dilapidated sofa of indiscriminate color and shape along the wall, a lazy boy of approximately the same vintage, and a gray formica kitchen table surrounded by 3 folding chairs, 2 brown, 1 off-brown. At the center of the room was one of those homemade stoves that you put together with 2 55-gallon drums. The underside of the bottom drum glowed orange, and I was sure it was close to 110 degrees in there. There was a half-hearted attempt at a tikka theme with native paintings of naked women and carved wooden sculptures as decoration. The most amazing stacks of magazines and catalogs towered against the walls. National Geographic and American Rifleman made up the visible majority. It was like being in the dead letter office on Fiji. I followed him in and reluctantly closed the door behind me as he threaded his way back to the kitchen area. He wasn't wearing a shirt, and his entire upper body was covered in tattoos. When he returned with a steaming cup of coffee, I expected to see an albatross hanging from his neck. He seated himself on the lazy boy and gestured for me to sit on the sofa. I pushed back my hat and looked at him. "Merchant Marine?" He scooped up his martini from a convenient stack.
"Goddamn 11th Engineers! You?"
"First Division."
"I'll be damned!"
He leaned forward and extended his hand, and we shook like old friends.
"Semper Fi, I bet you've seen some shit."
"Al, I need you to do something for me." He did his best to look serious.
"Name it."
I pulled the digital breathalyzer out of my jacket pocket and handed it to him as I took off my coat and laid it beside me. "Need you to blow into this." His eyes looked at the device, and then back at me, then he shrugged.
"No law against driving a mule drunk?"
"Only way you'd catch me on one." He blew into the device and handed it back to me.
"How'd I do, General?"
I tapped the breathalyzer, but it remained at 4.2. Rapidly approaching alcoholic coma. He toasted with his martini glass and added to the percentage of complex sugars already racing through his bloodstream.
"Al, how come I don't know you?"
He shrugged again. It seemed to be his favorite form of communication.
"I don't know. Hell, how come I don't know you?"
I looked down at my civilian clothes, my sheepskin coat, and the brim of my unadorned silver belly hat.
"Al, I'm the sheriff of Absaroka County."
"Really?" He processed the information for a moment.
"Where's that?"
"You're in it." He looked around as if there might be a sign.
"I thought we were in Bighorn County."
I studied him for a moment.
"You a bartender, Al?"
32 fucking years."
"How'd you get here?"
"Buddy and me partnered up and bought it off some asshole in Kemmerer."
"That where you live the rest of the year?"
"Lander." He took another sip of his martini, and I took the first sip of my coffee. It wasn't bad, and it was hot. "I need to ask you some questions." I tried not to concentrate on the fact that my primary witness had been drunk for the last 3 days. "Hear any loud noises early this morning?"
"Like that goddamn howitzer that went off just before dawn?"
Our eyes met.
"Hear that, did you?" "Well, hell, it's hunting season. So it's been sounding like a small arms war ever since I got here. Had to tie ribbons all over Sally so the simple-minded bastards wouldn't shoot her."
He paused for a second, remembering.
"But this was different, closer. And it was early, real early."
"I don't suppose you noticed what time it was." He sniffed.
"Oh, 5:12.
My eyes widened after making the translation.
"You sure of that?"
"Oh, hell yeah." He gestured to the large wind-up alarm clock that sat on the table.
"Looked at my clock."
"Then what?" He gestured.
"Went over here to the door and shouted for him to knock that shit off."
"Why did you go to this door?"
"It's where the shot came from."
"East or west?" He shook his head.
"Directly up the hill."
I nodded as he sipped his martini.
"That what killed that boy?"
"Maybe." I leaned forward and rested the coffee cup on my knee. It was still very hot. "When you went over to the door, did you open it and look out?"
"Yeah."
"Did you see anything?"
"Saw somebody walking back up through the tree line with their back to me."
My expression was probably easy to misinterpret.
"This any help?"
"I never had it so good. What did they look like?"
"Pretty big, near as I could tell. It was early, and there wasn't much light."
"Any distinguishing features? Hair?" He shook his head, no.
"Wait."
I could feel my heart beating.
"It was long."
I'm pretty sure I skipped a beat.
"Long hair." "Yeah, now that I think about it, yeah."
"You're sure about that?"
"Yeah, long hair."
"How long?"
"To the shoulders, at least."
"Color?"
"Dark."
But then he shook his head.
"Not enough light to tell, but dark, I think."
"Hat?"
"Nope."
"Could you tell what kind of clothing?" He nodded slowly.
"Overalls, one of those insulated jobs."
He waited for a minute.
"You okay?"
It took me a moment to think of a word and get some moisture in my mouth.
"Yep."
"This individual was carrying a weapon?"
"Yeah, a big one."
"Type?"
"Couldn't tell you. I mean, I could see him carrying something, and from the way he carried it..."
"Both hands?"
"Nope, one."